Welcome to Let's Talk About It, co-hosted by Maria Wyatt and Scott Dudley. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.
Good morning, Imperial Valley. You're listening to your weekly wellness radio, Let's Talk About It, with your host, Scott and Maria. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingue. Our phone number here at the station is 337-8874. Okay. Double checking with Mario.
Making sure we paid the phone bill this month.
Mario, that's Mario's job.
Welcome. Good morning. I'm Scott. She's Maria. And we have a great show for you today. We're going to jump right in because I'd like to talk to this guy probably for the rest of the morning, and we've only got an hour. So, again, 337-8874. Mark your phone numbers. Get your questions ready. We're here today with Steve Gutwillig. How's that, Steve? Is that even close?
Yeah, that's about it, Steve Gutwillig.
Thank you, sir. State Director of the California Drug Policy Alliance, and he's coming to us from the sunlit shores of Wilshire Boulevard. So, good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
From beautiful L.A. I miss it over there.
And it's really beautiful this morning.
It is. You're in between storms. You got another one coming in tomorrow, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, save us some water. We're downwind, you guys. And we typically, you guys squeeze it all out and put it in your reservoirs, and we have to go rob from Arizona to get our water. So
that's what we all do, robbing from Peter the Big Paul.
Yes, we do. So good morning, Stephen. How are you?
I'm doing great. Yourself?
I'm good. I'm good. So the topic today is drug policy.
Yes, drug policies. And one of the first things is, what is your organization about, the Drug Policy Alliance? What's your mission?
We're the nation's leading organization that works to advocate alternatives to the failed war on drugs. And what that essentially means is advocating policies that are based in science and compassion, in health and human rights. This is about shifting the way that we deal with both drugs and drug policies, the role that the government plays, away from a focus, if not an almost entire reliance on the criminal justice system as the way to deal with drug issues, and focusing on a health-centered approach, that the drugs and the problems caused by drugs are best addressed through health interventions, and that the criminal justice system is a blunt instrument that not only doesn't work to address the problems that the drugs create, they in fact make those problems worse.
So, Steve, failed drug war. Maybe they're holding an inside straight, and if they just double down on their hand, they're going to win this one. By what definition do you consider it failed? And is there any consensus among policymakers and politicians around the world that that's where they're at?
Well, I mean, it's one of the things where, and especially for us, we're a border city. You know, we are a border city. Our neighbor is Mexicali, which is the state capital of Baja California. And there's around 2 million people, and it's a corridor. It's a corridor for drugs. And it seems our government, you know, there's the more that they fight this war on drugs, there's more violence and there's more death.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So what the reaction is for our government is to double it up,
yeah.
You know, put more money into our border security. And I know that, you know, they build this huge fence across the U.S. and Mexico border, and they spend billions of dollars to construct it, and it takes billions of dollars to maintain it. And they did this to stop, you know, the drug smugglers, but, you know, that hasn't changed.
And they're not getting at the core issues, which, of course, is what is, you know, the seemingly insatiable demand for drugs of all kinds, legal, illicit drugs, prescription drugs. No one knows better than the folks on the border what failures of drug prohibition look like on the ground and how much worse things are getting. So when we talk about the failed war on drugs, what we're saying is that since President Nixon declared the war on drugs in the United States 40 years ago this June 17th, we're actually, you know, about to begin the commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the Declaration of the War on Drugs in 1971. Since then, the United States has spent upwards of $1 trillion in a futile attempt to create a drug-free society. And so, you know, there are many ways of looking at this. The most obvious one is there's never really been a drug-free society, you know, other than, you know, even if you go back thousands of years, people have been successfully trying to alter their consciousness, you know, from before recorded history, and that there's something that seems endemic to human culture that we seek to change our consciousness. It is, you know, it's why little kids run in circles. It's why we build roller coasters. It's why, you know, Avatar is in 3D. There are naturally occurring chemicals, and there are at this point a zillion synthetic chemicals that assist people in doing that, whether we like it or not. And there's really nothing that we can do through the use of government or the criminal justice system to keep people from doing that. And from our perspective, the worst thing that ever happened was the escalation of the drug war, first in its declaration under the Nixon administration, and then its escalation in the Reagan and Clinton years, to use the powers of the federal government, the law enforcement, and the enormous amount of money that the federal government started to funnel to local and state governments with the specific aim of increasing the criminalization of people who were possessing and using drugs for themselves. The thing that is often lost in the some amount of support that understandably exists for the drug war. I mean, of course, people, you know, have very strong feelings about the impact that drugs have on individuals and families, people we care about, on communities. People are understandably not very charitable when they think about drug dealers and when they think about drug trafficking in general. The reality of the drug war, as it has been promoted and executed in this country, is that the vast majority of people being arrested, upwards of 80% and 90% of drug arrests, of the 1.8 million drug arrests in this country, the vast majority of those are for personal possession of drugs, petty possession. The war on drugs is a war on individual drug users. It is not primarily a war on drug trafficking, on drug smuggling, on drug dealing. It is a war against individuals, which then plays out as a result of the mass arrests, mass criminalization, and mass incarceration. It plays out as a war on communities, particularly a war on low-income communities of color.
Stephen, let me kind of jump in because, you guys are pretty hip, I'm sure, over there. And one of the things I've noticed about governments is when they label things, typically they don't always, it's not like truth in advertising applies to government policy. And so you've got things like the Patriot Act, which is the name for the expansion of state police powers. And so the war on drugs, I'm wondering if, you could say it's failed because maybe that wasn't the intent of the war on drugs. I mean, if the intent of the war on drugs was to
protect,
disenfranchise people of color, and particularly young men, and particularly people of less economic status, it seems to be working really, really well.
I would completely agree with you, and that's also the history of drug control policy in this country. And that, I mean, I'll just say, you know, that if the war on drugs is meant to control drugs and keep them away from young people and reduce the number of people who are consuming them in significant ways and reduce addiction, well, drugs are cheaper, more potent, more widely available than they ever have been, despite this $1 trillion spent over the last 40 years. But the truth is, as you point out, this isn't really about drugs. It never really has been. Historically, by far the single most important determinant of which drugs were legal and which drugs are illegal, just based on government policy, was not the harms that are associated with drugs, not which drugs are most addictive and most harmful. The single most important factor in determining which drugs were made illegal was who was perceived to be using them. And so that, you know, that goes back to the very first drug laws in this country in the late 19th century, which is the criminalization of opium based on the use of opium by...
We outsmarted them. We invented OxyContin.
Exactly right. But it was Chinese railroad workers in the western states. The criminalization of marijuana at the turn of the century was entirely about the criminalization of Mexicans in the Southwest and in Western states. The criminalization of cocaine in the 1920s was specifically, the historic record is very clear about this, was about criminalizing African American men. It has been about race all along, at the root. These laws do not have any moral legitimacy in their origins, which is bad enough. The problem then is that the drug laws have always been enforced selectively against Latinos and African Americans in this country.
But here's where I get confused, because now you've got an African American in the White House. You've got, as of last November, you had complete Democratic control of all the houses and Senate. Yet nobody was standing up screaming Jim Crow laws. Nobody was standing up saying this is a marginalization of this whole section of society.
Sure. And well, I mean, they did. There have been some changes. So starting from when Barack Obama was on the campaign trail, he has been very clear that he believes that drugs are an issue that should be addressed primarily as a matter of health, not of criminal justice. So he said the right thing in general, and he repeated that a couple of weeks ago at a town hall, where the questions were drawn from the internet, and the top 200 questions that were addressed to Barack Obama on the internet, the top 200 were about ending drug prohibition and marijuana legalization in particular.
You know, one could almost presuppose, though, I mean, with his stated background of experimentation and use, that if he hadn't been raised by his white grandparents, we would be looking at just another African-American drug farm.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, it's pretty clear when you look at the admitted drug use of, well, certainly at least the last three presidents, and then now every presidential contender feels a level of comfort referring to their past marijuana use. The president also has written in his autobiography about his past cocaine use. But it's very, very clear that a single arrest, let alone a felony conviction for drug possession, would have been a career ender.
That would have been it.
That would have been it.
Yeah.
Never,
no college, never, no jobs, no loans.
Absolutely. And in this country, for young black men are overwhelmingly targeted by law enforcement, based on where policing occurs, and obviously, in certain communities, we're talking about, the enormous disproportionate targeting of Latinos as well.
We call that probable cause, don't we?
That's exactly right. I mean, it is a big part of walking down the street or driving while being a person of color in this country, that it is the Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizures do not apply when it comes to drugs, and they certainly don't apply when it comes to low-income black and brown people. And the Supreme Court has been relatively clear that it is okay when the police are searching for drugs or enforcing the drug laws, that it is absolutely okay to look the other way when it comes to unreasonable searches and seizures. And it is, the best example of that is fairly shocking, is in New York City, which is the marijuana arrest capital of the world. This is a state, in New York State, that decriminalized low-level possession of marijuana in the 1970s, in the late 1970s, and so it is not a crime to possess up to an ounce of marijuana in New York State. However, it is a crime to have marijuana in public view, which is the language of the law. In public view is meant to be about, you know, you can't smoke marijuana in public. You can possess small amounts of it, but you can't smoke it. But because the language is that vague, in public view, the police routinely tell people to empty their pockets or go through their pockets, you know, young men of color, and find small amounts of marijuana and arrest them, not for the possession, which is legal, but for having marijuana in public view. They trick them into emptying their pockets and then arrest them for having marijuana in public view, to the point now where you know, tens of thousands, I mean, they have arrested more people for marijuana possession in New York City than any other crime in New York City. There is it's 15% of all arrests in New York City. In California, up until this last year, we had a similar situation where police were making, you know, enormous numbers of arrests, but, you know, as part of the routine level of over-policing in low-income communities. Marijuana arrests were completely out of control. But this is what we, you know, this is what most of us mean by the failed drug war. But for other people, it means things like the public health disaster that the focus on criminalization of drug possession and drug use means. It, you know, it means that at this point, overdose has become the second leading cause of accidental death in the country, and you know, second only to car accidents, because there is no focus on how to prevent the out of control use and diversion of prescription painkillers, right? I mean, overdose is not primarily about heroin anymore. It is now primarily middle-aged white men ODing on OxyContin and Vicodin and all the rest of them. And the U.S. government has no approach to dealing with that because it's so focused on criminalization. It means out of control spread of HIV and hepatitis C through injection drug use, because we're so focused on the criminalization, and all sorts of other harms that are done to families. Instead of focusing on a health-centered approach to drugs, we focus on putting as many people as possible behind bars. And just to say, you know, what some of those numbers are, it's really fairly shocking. Many people, you know that the United States is the world's largest jailer. We have 5% of, just under 5% of the world's population living in this country, yet we have more than 25% of the world's prisoners.
Yes, that's true. We're in one of the Amnesty International.
Right.
We're on the list.
Right.
We were told that was highest. Jobs creation, Stephen.
Yes, exactly. It is for a certain segment of the population, and I know the
high school graduates, you know, they got to do something, right?
That's right. All the, you know, and we all, you know, among progressives, we're fairly familiar with the strength of the prison guards union in this country. But this is an issue that really spans the social and racial justice left and the libertarian right. I mean, what it is, well, you know, how is it that we have that we are spending $40 billion a year essentially policing what people are putting in their own bodies and arresting and incarcerating people who are not harming anyone except perhaps themselves? And, you know, how is it that that became okay in, you know, in a democracy, that we are actually criminalizing people solely on the basis of what they're putting in their own bodies, without harming other people? Libertarians have always been way in front, and in front of a lot of progressives and mainstream civil rights organizations denouncing the war on drugs. And this, you know, this has to stop. And these are the policies. It's worth noting that the single largest driver of the expansion of the number of people incarcerated in this country has been the drug laws. The, you know, since the 80s, when the Reagan administration, and then you know, eagerly picked up by the Clinton administration, expanded and escalated the war on drugs, that's when mass arrests and mass incarceration of low-level, nonviolent drug offenders took off. and the prison population exploded. So today, you know, of the around 2.3 million people who are behind bars in this country, you know, that is one in 99 American adults is actually behind bars, not just in the system, right? That's a whole bunch of millions more. It's 5 million more people. 2.3 million people are actually behind bars. Half a million of them are there for drug offenses. And that's a lot of people, right? Half a million people behind bars in this country for drug offenses is more than the European Union, which has 100 million more people than we do, incarcerates for all crimes combined.
And that's a lot of people whose lives, their futures have been affected.
Exactly right. The impact
They could have been a potential presidential candidate in there.
Right.
No
it's
more.
It's an enormous waste of, you know, of human potential. A felony drug conviction is certainly a game changer. For many people, it's a game ender.
Oh, yeah.
A felony drug conviction is a form of stigma now. There's an extremely important book called The New Jim Crow by a woman named Michelle Alexander that came out last year that goes through the very, very useful explanation of how the war on drugs focused on young men of color, particularly young African American men, is the new Jim Crow in the sense that every single form of state-sponsored discrimination that existed in the Jim Crow era is now applied to people that are referred to as felons, that it is okay to deny them housing, education, all sorts of, you know, they can't vote for the most part, depending on where they live in this country.
They cannot
access mainstream society. It's a form of permanent subjugation, marginalization, and second-class citizenship, and it's entirely legal. And, you know, this is the most important thing that we can do is, when it comes to ending the war on drugs, is keeping people out of that system in the first place. There's a lot of focus starting, you know, with the new Attorney General and the new governor of California, Kamala Harris and Jerry Brown, on reducing the prison population, mostly through talking about reentry, mostly talking about fixing the ridiculous rate of recidivism that we have, which is double the national average. I mean, we have by far the highest rate of people returning to state prison by virtue of the complete failure that we have to help people reintegrate in society. And that's because it's bigger than that. It's bigger than any one state can do, the stigma that exists for convicted felons. The real way to reduce the prison population is at the front end of the system. We have to stop putting people in there in the first place because, nonviolent, non-sexual, non-serious drug offenders don't belong, for the most part, don't belong in state prison in the first place. We're spending over $1 billion every year incarcerating them.
We're talking to Stephen Gutwilling, and he's the state director of the California Drug Policy Alliance. 337-8874 is the phone number. So, Steve, what you're talking about, this aka the war on drugs, which, you know, you can't really declare war on inanimate objects, but that's a whole other story, I suppose, is a failure on multiple fronts. I mean, right before we're right on the top of the hour, but, you know, in 3 or 4 minutes, you could summarize, I guess, how many different fronts this is failing on. And then after the break, what we'll do is we'll dive into, you know, how we begin to address this from some other perspectives,
sure.
I suppose.
Sure. I mean, the most obvious ones are that the war on drugs does nothing, has succeeded in none of its goals. I mean, drugs are widely available, you know, especially to young people, and the harms that are associated with drug use and drug misuse are being radically escalated by driving consumption underground. And, something like a quarter of all families in the state of California are touched by drug addiction. No one needs to lecture anyone listening to this.
Everybody knows. Probably everybody.
Knows,
yeah.
Right? We all know.
It's like someone.
This is not
family.
This, you know, the movement to end the war on drugs is not a movement of, you know, of people who want drugs to be made more available. It's not a movement of, you know, exclusively of people who love drugs. It's actually a combination of people. You know, some people like drugs, some people hate drugs, and some people don't care about drugs one way or another, but know that the war on drugs does more harm than good. And, you know, what that mostly looks like is the extraordinary focus on criminalization, which, you know, a word we keep using, but it is exactly the right word for it, the focus of the criminal justice system as the one-size-fits-all response to drug use, and not addressing the woeful lack of access to drug treatment.
We've been affected with that.
it is extraordinary. I mean, not that drug treatment is a silver bullet. Many people, of course, have the experience.
Well, from a libertarian standpoint, most people who are using drugs, frankly, just want to be left alone.
Well, yeah, and most people who use drugs, of course, aren't hurting anyone, including themselves. Obviously, there are many people who fall into some kind of dependency and need help, and there are obviously people who, once exposed to drug taking, you know, it completely changes their lives and their relationships to other people, and these are people who need help. They don't need to be put in cages. There are, of course, some individuals who have the experience that their brush with the criminal justice system, even their incarceration, was actually a wake-up call to them. However, that is not the experience of most people. Most people caught up in the criminal justice system are not there because this is some kind of useful intervention. It is quite the opposite. It rips families apart. It takes children away from their mm-hmm. parents, and it decimates the ability of individuals to earn a living and to become productive members of society. And so we advocate for a complete shift in this paradigm to focusing on health-centered approaches to drug use and drug misuse and to drug control policies. And the first place you would start is by substantially increasing the resources that are available for drug treatment. We, of course, think that there should be treatment on demand for anyone who wants it, and we have quite the opposite in this country. 4 out of 5 people who want access to drug treatment can't afford it, and in the state of California, you can imagine who the largest supplier of drug treatment is. It's the criminal justice system at this point, and the treatment that's available behind bars is not very effective, and not of the kind of quality that you can imagine that wealthy people are getting on the outside.
All right, Steve. You know what? It's top of the hour. We're going to have to jump in and take a quick break. We'll be back with more of Stig Gutwillig from the Drug Policy Alliance right after this break. This is Let's Talk About It, your voice for wellness.
You're listening to Let's Talk About It, presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services, each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM Radio Bilingue.
Welcome back. You're still listening to Let's Talk About It, your wellness radio for Imperial and Mexicali Valleys. We are brought to you by Imperial County Behavioral Health and KUBO 88.7 Radio Bilingue. And our phone number here at the station is 760-337-8874. And if you missed the first half of this show, you can always access it through kxoradio.com and through our podcast.
Through the expert production of Mario Espinosa.
Yes.
Yay. Welcome back. We're here today with Stephen Goodwillig, and he is the state director of the California Drug Policy Alliance. And the topic on the table today is the war on drugs and what your Drug Policy Alliance is doing to try and perhaps reframe this problem towards different solutions.
And it's a very touchy subject, because as families here in the Valley and people, they, you know, you hear drugs and it's just, oh my gosh, you know, I don't want that in my family. It causes a lot of crime, deaths, violence, and to try to legalize them, goes all against what people believe about drugs.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting. Yeah, she, I'll pile on to Maria here. You know, we've got like 30% unemployment. We've got a drug corridor. The gangs came in a long time ago and kind of established their marketing stuff for getting substances up to L.A., frankly. And so we have this whole place where people can get caught up in that end of it. We have plenty of pain and other types of human suffering, which gets people caught up in that end of it. But the other thing here is honestly, if you look at border interdiction employment and correctional employment, we got a lot of people working in the industry now who didn't have jobs or opportunities prior to this kind of like, hey, it's a desert, let's just build lots of prisons.
Well, that's what we have here in the Valley. We have a lot of immigration, the ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. We have a lot of Border Patrol, and we have two state prisons here in the Valley. We have our population is of 148,000.
Yeah.
And we have two state prisons, Centinela and Calipat.
So we've only got like three people in the entire county, not on either one side or the other.
You are perfectly illustrating the fundamental truth about the drug war, which is who profits from it. There are two groups that profit from these prohibitionist policies, and those are criminals and the people who chase after criminals. And the escalation of the conflict between the two of them is causing unprecedented carnage, you know, on both sides of the border, but obviously most clearly in Mexico itself. And this is a tragedy of you know that we have not seen before. And at this point, most Americans aren't directly touched by the. By what is going on since the Calderon administration declared, its war on the traffickers. But, you know, this is not sustainable. It's not going to work. It's, adding violence to violence and escalating the sort of military response to drug trafficking is, going to cause the needless deaths of thousands more people.
Stephen, you might like this. You know, in our community, we can't go to Disneyland. We can't go visit and experience the American dream without passing a border checkpoint, without passing a checkpoint where we suspend our rights and have somebody ask us.
Like, I have to add, actually, you know, we're U.S. citizens. We are, you know, Scott and I, we were both born here, and we still have to ask what our citizenship is in our own country.
Mm. And wait in lines.
Wait in line, you know, to go to San Diego, to go to L.A. We have to, you know, I'm thinking, oh, gosh, I'm going to have to start carrying my passport and prove that, you know, I am an American. You know, my mom was born in Mexico, my dad was born here. But, you know, I have to, and my husband jokes about it. Hey, you have your passports? You have your papers?
Right. I mean, it's extraordinary, right? Because it's wrong on so many levels. From an individual personal liberty perspective, from a racial justice perspective, and from a public policy perspective. I mean, this kind of whack-a-mole strategy of actually thinking that we're going to be able to use ICE and other forms of law enforcement to build a moat around ourselves and keep the drugs out is absurd. What we have now is just a variation of the or changes in the drug smuggling routes since there was a focus on cracking down on smugglers and traffickers in South America. So they've, you know, as many of your listeners know, there's a shift in the routes through Mexico and a building up of the cartels within Mexico as a result. I mean, this is a global commodities market that has been created by prohibition itself. And this is the thing. It's very hard for those of us who have been directly impacted buy drugs and the drug war, to you know, to remember that the reason that there is so much crime, violence, corruption, and suffering is in large part not a direct result of the drugs themselves, but of the drug money mm-hmm. that prohibition makes possible. The drugs would not be worth what they're worth. These are, you know, for the most part, these are plants and chemicals that, you know, whose value has been wildly inflated because of the because they're illegal. It's what makes them so expensive, because people are basically paying, drug users are paying the tax of what it costs for drug traffickers and drug sellers to take the risk to sell them. And it's this is not a way to actually reduce the availability and the whole system of drug trafficking, because it basically is, you know, like any kind of commodities market, it's supply and demand, and if you reduce the supply here, it's going to pop up somewhere else. It's going to make drugs even more expensive, and which is the truth, right? Drugs at this point basically are cheaper than they were 20 years ago, all drugs, and that's because the escalation of the war on drugs has completely failed, and it has put even more people in the business of selling them because it's so lucrative. And it's just, you know, I mean, the economics of this are really they're very complex, and I'm simplifying it.
That's why a lot of people
to these basic principles. But yeah, exactly, the number of people who are now engaged in the in trafficking drugs, because it's the only form of employment that's available. It's a kind of economic development.
Yeah.
It's a really twisted form of economic development that is brought to you by the war on drugs. And just to be clear, we don't advocate the legalization of all drugs. I mean, it's something that that's just sort of worth noting at this point. I mean, we as I said, at the Drug Policy Alliance, well, because it's more complicated than that. We favor the full legalization and taxing and regulating of marijuana.
Which technically is a plant, not a drug.
Right. You know. Well. Yeah. Although many, you know, cocaine comes from a plant. Heroin.
Cocaine is actually a drug that comes from a plant.
Right. I mean, you know, most of them are, right, except for when you get into a lot of prescription drugs. The alternatives to the drug war and to banning these drugs outright is what we refer to as a health-centered approach, and that for us that means you look at each drug one at a time, you decide, you know, what the relative harms are and what the best way of controlling them would be. You know, the most obvious goals are to keep drugs of all kinds out of the hands of young people, out of the hands of people.
Now, with that, what you're saying, you know, you look at that. I mean, and now I'm looking at alcohol.
Yes.
Alcohol is very legal.
Yes.
You know, as long as you're 21 and, you know, it's very legal, you can just go out to the anytime during the day and buy alcohol and drink it and enjoy it. But the harm that it causes is so much, it's so great. And alcohol kills a lot more people than all the drugs combined.
Absolutely, it does. It's about 100,000 people a year in this country die as a direct result of alcohol consumption, and that's not including that's not including accidents and the like. I mean, this is, you know,
and the violence that it causes,
yeah,
domestic violence,
yep.
You know, sexual abuse.
And then you add cigarettes to that. I mean, cigarettes are, you know, are by far the most addictive and highly consumed.
But this is all political,
right? And it's interesting because alcohol especially illustrates the challenges around drug policy, because we experimented in this country in the 1920s and 30s with banning alcohol outright, with alcohol prohibition, and it was the kind of colossal failure that we have seen with the current war on drugs started in the 70s in this country. Yet we chose at the end of the 13-year failed experiment with alcohol prohibition to regulate alcohol and to place age and content restrictions on it and to allow states to regulate sales of alcohol to adults as they saw fit.
What were, you know, Stephen, what were the politically compelling reasons for that? It must have, I'm imagining it's not as convenient as people waking up in the morning saying, oh, failed experiment, let's just fix
it. Yeah, there was all of the kinds of horrors that we see today,
yeah,
but on a much smaller scale. There was out-of-control crime, violence, and corruption. There were people dying left and right, and actually in fairly large numbers as a result of ingesting adulterated alcohol. And people were making alcohol. People,
mm-hmm,
were smuggling alcohol that contained all sorts of impurities and poisons. And people, you know, many people died in that 13-year period, thousands of people from bootleg alcohol, and it is, you know, all the parallels are enormous, right? The war on alcohol was largely started, for economic and political reasons. There was a big movement of parents, particularly women, who wanted to see alcohol outlawed because of the out of control domestic violence that was caused by alcohol, but 13 years later, the movement to restore, to end alcohol prohibition, to make it legal again, was actually led again by women who saw that the harms created by the outright ban were even worse than what they had endured when alcohol was legal, and that they wanted to see it controlled rather than the complete chaos that prohibition creates, and that parallels, you know, is completely familiar to us today.
That's where we're at today with the
right.
drug,
exactly.
the war on drugs.
Except we're missing the political expediency. That seems to be the missing link here.
That's
because
right. Although there was an equivalent of that under alcohol prohibition, but you're right. I mean, this is alcohol prohibition on steroids. That when you ban these substances outright, you create an enormous incentive for criminals to take control of the market, and so you end up with this enormous underground economy and all the crime, violence, corruption, and out of control youth access that you get with the black market. And that's, you know, obviously in the case of marijuana, that is completely out of proportion to the harms that are associated with marijuana. Marijuana is objectively less harmful than either alcohol or cigarettes, and that there's never been an independent study about how marijuana should be controlled that said that it should be illegal. Like, you know, starting with the Nixon administration, every independent study of professionals, which included health professionals, has determined that marijuana should be controlled in the manner that we control alcohol and cigarettes. Although, as many of us know, we don't do a very good job of regulating alcohol.
No.
And so it's not like alcohol is some kind of model, especially in the state of California, where you can buy alcohol at a gas station of all places. I mean, there's a lot of politics to alcohol.
They actually put alcohol in the gas now.
Yeah, right.
But there is.
Right, but, you know, there is a balance to be found between controls that don't criminalize and don't put all the power in the hands of law enforcement and, you know, create all these incentives to lock people up, and figuring out how to regulate these substances in ways that don't contribute unnecessarily to disease, to death, and to addiction. Right now, we are so focused on the use of the criminal justice system and to arresting and locking people up that we are allowing most people with addiction issues to go untreated. Because we just simply don't have the money, because it's all
there's no funding.
You know, there's no funding for for healthcare in general, for education, for, you know, all sorts of social services, you know, and in the state of California, the only segment of the state budget that is, that has remained essentially untouched during the fiscal crisis is the prison system. And even Jerry Brown's current budget is really frightening in the way that it cuts all sorts of crucial services, cuts education, and leaves the correction system basically untouched. And it is now we now spend more money on the prison system in California than we do on higher education. It has obviously been
sad.
It has been growing at a faster rate than higher education for many, many years.
Because we still, I mean, the budget is still, the budget from the state of California, about 50% of it goes to education.
That includes pre-K, K through 12,
yes,
and higher education.
Mm-hmm.
Higher education as a chunk of the budget has been shrinking while the prison system has continued to expand, because essentially corrections get a blank check, because even though there is a number in the budget where if they keep arresting people and they keep convicting and incarcerating people, they don't just release people because they reach the threshold in the budget. They just simply keep going and
build more prisons.
That's right. And the legislature just authorizes increased correction spending at least once a year in order to meet the demand. And this is, it's out of control. We have a prison overcrowding crisis in California that's been going on for years. Federal judges have taken over the healthcare portion of our prison system in California because they ruled that there are unconstitutional levels of healthcare provided to the 150,000 to 170,000 people in California prison at any given time. Someone dies every week on average in the California prison system unnecessarily, usually from untreated asthma. We don't have the resources. We can't afford to build a world-class prison system at a time that we are decimating education and health and human services.
Well, people, I mean, the prisoners that you should be there should be like the rapists, the murderers, violent offenders.
Yeah, and we spend, we lock up at this point almost 10,000 people in state prison, not in county jails, in the 33 state prisons, we have over 9,000 people who are there for petty drug possession. At a cost of $1 billion a year, and then there's another $1 billion that we spend on people who are in state prison for other nonviolent drug possession offenses.
So Stephen, you're holding all the logic cards, frankly. I mean, you've made like a 50-minute compelling argument that none of this makes any sense at all. How do you compete against the politics of fear?
Well,
how do you compete against something where all I have to do to market myself is to say scary things, and I'm going to get the political clout of whatever I'm trying to do? And so you've got like the Correctional Officers Union, which is clearly going to be invested in not necessarily drug policy, but certainly protecting their jobs and stuff. And you've got law enforcement, and you've got all the federal people that are here now. So you've got a lot of political people lined up against you, and all they have to do is say scary things. How do you fight through that?
That's the perfect question for us to
because fear beats logic.
And here's the deal.
Yeah.
The deal is that there is momentum now, and the wind is suddenly at the backs of drug policy reformers for the first time in several decades, largely driven by the federal and local fiscal crisis. It is now generally understood.
So you're cashing in on the pain of the taxpayers?
Basically the taxpayers are saying enough is enough. We cannot arrest our way out of the problems caused by drugs. And
it's not working.
So we'll let all the teachers go, and then we'll close down all public health services.
and for the first time, In states at this point, California is usually a leader in this kind of reform, but and it has a lot to do with the politics in Sacramento of these enormous Democratic majorities that have existed in both houses of the legislature for 30 years, but they're terrified of holding on, of losing those majorities by being labeled soft on crime and soft on drugs. But like in other states are leading the way to change their drug laws. It's already happening. It's happening in Texas, in Florida, and in a bunch of other major states where they're basically saying, okay, we can't afford to lock up people that we're mad at because they consumed or possessed drugs or perhaps sold drugs. We have to focus our scarce law enforcement and court resources and prison resources on people we are actually afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
And that, there is a movement to be smart on crime instead of just simply tough, generically tough on crime. There's a movement among people on the right. There's an actual organization now called Right on Crime, which is conservatives saying we have to reform the criminal justice system in this country, specifically along the lines that we've been discussing in this hour, which is to focus on violent and serious offenders, to save scarce prison space for the people who seriously need to be separated from society, and to expand the kinds of services that we're talking about. This is not going to happen overnight. We're talking about turning a battleship or a luxury liner around, and that's not something that can happen overnight. The Obama administration has taken a number of important steps in the right direction. They ended the federal ban on using federal money to make clean needles available, sterile syringes available to people, to injection drug users, to stop the spread of HIV and hepatitis C. They changed the federal government's policy on medical marijuana to so that the federal government would no longer unilaterally arrest and prosecute people for violations of federal law, even if they were complying with local medical marijuana laws. And most importantly, the Obama administration got behind the reform of the sentencing of the mandatory minimum sentences for possession of crack cocaine, which is, as many of your listeners may know, there was this 100-to-1 disparity
mm-hmm.
in the sentencing for crack as opposed to powder cocaine, mm-hmm. which had extraordinary impacts on African-American drug possession offenders.
So we'll be doing reparations to those people who are unfairly corrupted.
Well, right. I mean, we have to start by getting a lot of them out of prison. And so there are, the wall is cracking, both at the national level and internationally. We've heard, and I'm sure, a lot of your listeners are paying attention to voices within Mexico, former President Vicente Fox, and others, and the former presidents of Latin American countries are actually saying, they're certainly saying that we have to debate drug legalization. That everything has to be on the table, including a completely different approach. People are saying that marijuana needs to be taken out of the criminal justice system and regulated along the lines of alcohol. But it is now largely driven by a combination of the fiscal crisis and the death and destruction caused by the war in Mexico.
Steven,
everything is suddenly now being discussed in a way that in which politics is not being allowed to trump science and
mm-hmm.
facts, and so suddenly there's a real desire to put facts on the table.
The media also has a big part. We live here in the border city, and we hear a lot about people being murdered or beheaded in Mexicali because of between the drug traffickers, and there's a lot of fear. So if there's a lot of work to do, if we want to you know, change these drug policies because of the fear that some people still have. You know, I've known people that lived here all their lives, and now they're afraid of going into Mexico.
Yes.
They don't want to go in there.
Yeah, and so your listeners really need to hold the media accountable and tell, you know, and have them address the whole picture, because obviously, you know, the mainstream journalists do a very good job of creating panics and reflecting the scariest, most sensational aspects of, you know, around drug use and around drug prohibition.
We thought that's what we were doing by booking you, Stephen.
Yes.
Right. So you need to, people, we need to say to reporters, why are you not covering that, you know, the economics of the drug war? Why are you, you know, you need to report all, you know, all of this stuff and talk about the relative harms of drugs. We need to talk about, we need to report on the debate that is now occurring. We have to stop pretending that, that there's only one way to address this and figure out who, and let's start reporting on how much the prison industrial complex and the law enforcement lobby are behind keeping the policies the way they are, folks who are directly profiting from the system as it currently exists.
Stephen, if people are interested in learning more about your policy alliance or contacting you or being a part of this.
Drug Policy Alliance is a national organization, and you can find us online at drugpolicy.org. And we're a membership organization with hundreds of thousands of people across the country. You can get alerts from us online and take action to impact drug policy around the country and in California as well. So www.drugpolicy.org.
What is, and one last one question, what are we doing, or what is the Drug Policy Alliance doing here in California? Anything else? And, you know, Proposition 19 did not pass.
So
what are we doing? What's the next step?
So we're doing a couple of things. One is that you will likely see another marijuana legalization initiative on the ballot in 2012. We are going to be working on that as we did with Proposition 19. We believe that that marijuana needs to be removed completely from the criminal justice system. There's just simply, you know, we have to end the moralizing and manage the realities of marijuana, and banning it outright is a complete waste of scarce enforcement resources. We're also working to expand access to medical marijuana in California and to regulate that system in a way that will work better for both patients and non-patients than it does. We're working to increase access to clean needles to stop the spread of HIV and other bloodborne diseases, and we're working in California to reduce overdose fatalities with a bill that's called the 911 Good Samaritan Bill that says that that if someone is having an overdose, it should not be a crime to call
probable
to call 911, mm-hmm. and that, you know, people who call 911 from the scene of an overdose should not be subject to arrest for drug possession, which is a simple thing that, if you know, that even though you would think it's common sense that we would want to save a life before we would prioritize arresting people, it actually doesn't work that way.
You first arrest and then
save. And most people don't call 911 from the scene of an overdose. They're afraid. And so we need to turn that around and basically say, actually, we think the preservation of human life is the most important thing at the scene, in the case of an overdose, and our policy should reflect that.
Stephen, the guy who turns off the show isn't here, so we're going to keep rolling on this one. Yeah, I got a question. Here's a point of curiosity, I guess, for me. You know, you've got this whole youth culture thing going on, and one of the things that they've got going on is the rave culture, and so you've got events like Electronic Daisy at the Coliseum that's drawing in 200,000 people who predominantly are being safe and predominantly are having a great time and predominantly are using drugs. What do you do with something like that for your policy people?
Yeah, and there's an interesting controversy that's occurring in LA County right now where I live over the Department of Public Health issuing a fact card about ecstasy that was actually reality-based and fact-based, told, you know, it it it's it uh it reflected the principles of a philosophy called harm reduction, which the Drug Policy Alliance believes in. And that philosophy, sort of the opposite of the war on drugs, it basically says that we should focus on reducing the harms associated both with drug use and with drug prohibition, that people need to be told the facts and the
educated
truth about drugs, that more information, more education is always the best response.
Including including how to properly take them?
Including how to, just like sex education or having seat belts in cars, that it's important for people to stay safe, and that what the first thing we need to do is keep people alive, that people are going to take these drugs no matter how much we discourage them and no matter how much, in fact, we criminalize. I mean, that has been the history of the drug war, that the criminalization actually is not a disincentive for many, many people. And so if young people are going to take ecstasy and other mind-altering substances, the first thing we need to do is make sure that they know the harms that are associated with that, to not lie to them, to give them the facts and a reality-based approach rather than a fear-based one, because young people just ignore what they think is an attempt to just simply lie to them or tell them to completely abstain. It's an approach that has failed, the just say no approach. I mean, young people don't, it doesn't work for most young people. And so the approach that we favor is a reality-based one in which young people are given the facts, they are told the harms that are associated, and they are strongly discouraged from ingesting anything
is of unknown chemical origin.
And that goes for alcohol, for cigarettes, and for all mind-altering substances. It's just not a good idea for young people to take any of it. That the truth is that young people do ingest all of those things in large numbers, and so we can't bury our heads in the sand. We have to help them stay safe. Not teach them how to do it, but tell them what they need to know to stay alive. And the rave culture is a very interesting one, especially these large raves, for example, at the Coliseum that you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
because it's a really good example of one of the ways to help young people stay safe is to make sure that what they're doing is happening above ground and in the light of day. Because if you outlaw these kinds of raves, the rave culture is going to go back underground where it was for a long time. Whereas you can imagine the ability to control what's going on has been completely undermined, and the likelihood of overdose and overdose deaths will be magnified.
Well, and Stephen, I mean, the other thing is, if you have this thing in the Coliseum, LA County's walking away with a crap load of money. They wouldn't have gotten
otherwise. They made a lot of money.
Yeah, so of course there is a lot of people, I don't think that we should be, that this kind of event should be a profit center for, this is me speaking personally. It's like, for me, the main goal would be to make sure that young people are given a safe space to enjoy themselves, and that there are medical professionals available, that there's information available, so that they can make decisions that are in their best interest. When you add to that a profit motive, you can sometimes confuse a public health goal and a fiscal goal. So to me, keeping people healthy, safe, and alive has always got to be first.
Yeah.
And that's similar to how we approach drug policy in general. That you can't paint all drugs with a single brush. That you have to, marijuana is different from methamphetamine, which is different from heroin. There is no one answer to all of them. Some of them some of them, which can be regulated safely for adult consumption and controlled that way through education and through age restrictions and content restrictions. And some of them have to be treated, you know, in a much more restrictive way. But what we do know at this point is that driving that consumption underground, creating this enormous incentive for criminals to control every aspect of the drug market is a complete disaster and is never going to work, and that the war on drugs does far more harm than good.
All right, Stephen. Thanks so much for coming aboard today, Stephen
Gutwillig
from the Drug Policy Alliance State Director. Appreciate your time,
pleasure,
sir.
And again, you know, if you need more information or the webpage, the web address is drugpolicy.org. But thank you. Thank you, Steve, for coming on.
And say you heard about it, and let's talk about it, and they'll give you free stuff.
And also, you can also access this show by next week on our podcast or in a couple of days at kxoradio.com.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much, and have a good weekend.
You've been listening to Let's Talk About It, heard each Thursday morning at 7:30 a.m. on KUBO 88.7 FM, Radio Bilingue. Presented by Imperial County Behavioral Health Services and brought to you as a podcast by KXORadio.com.